Sai's Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m. Om Shri Sai Ram. You just heard a latest offering of the Indian National Anthem, Janagana Mana, at the lotus feet of our Divine Chancellor by members of the Radio Sai team, and we hope you liked it. Loving salutations at the lotus feet of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, the voice, the ears, the heart and soul of Radio Sai. And Independence Day greetings to our global listeners. India is celebrating her 67th Independence Day today, and Team Radio Sai salutes our motherland Bharat on this special day, and more importantly, we salute the supreme custodian and reviver of Bharat's glory, our dearest Bhagwan Baba. Sai Ram and welcome to Thursday Live. You're tuned to our Asia stream coming to you live from Prashanti Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. My name is Karuna and I will be hosting this segment called Morning Glory. On the sound console is audio engineer Brother Ganesh. Thank you for staying with us on yet another very pleasant Thursday morning here in the ashram. Today is the 15th of August 2013. The time right now in the studio is 9:44 a.m. Bhagwan Baba always encouraged love for the motherland. Quite naturally then, on this Independence Day of India, all high schools and colleges across the nation are celebrating the day with patriotic fervor. It's the same with the SAI Learning Centers here in the Divine Valley, and we are quite looking forward to some special presentations in the Mandir this evening related to the glory of Sanatan Dharma and Bharat, as Bhagwan preferred to refer to India as. As a matter of fact, while coming into office this morning, I saw the students at various SAI schools and hostels lined up along the Vidyagiri campus hoisting flags. In the primary school and Ishwaramba school, students were standing in attention, perhaps singing the national anthem. And the Ganesha of the higher secondary school was really celebrating with the students. They had donned the tricolor Indian flag on the four pillars of his little temple at the entrance of their hostel compound. It was such a lovely sight to behold. And through the celebrations, the ashram is enjoying ideal weather conditions. The monsoon is tracking on time. We had lots of showers last night, and what's adding to the blissful ambience of the ashram is this heady mix of regular Vedam chanting, the melodious bhajans, the pleasant breeze, comfortable temperatures, lush green parks, and relaxed faces everywhere. It's being suggested, unofficially of course, that the ashram be designated a stress-free zone in this world of hustle and bustle. It has this deep peace that seeps into your soul and bones once we walk in through the Ganesha gate. By the way, since the past week, the ashram and its allied institutions are being ably served by Sevadal volunteers from the Sri Sathya Sai Seva organization of Delhi NCR. Now, before we go any further, today being the Indian Independence Day, let us reflect on what Baba said about the glory of Bharat, the only country where Purna avatars are born. I quote Bhagwan, "Everything has originated from Bharat. Hence, having taken birth in Bharat, strive to promote the glory of Bharat. Every devotee should take a pledge to protect and promote the greatness of Bharat. Like an elephant that does not know its own strength, Bharatiyas are unaware of their power. Despite their myriad capacities, they are behaving as weaklings, like an elephant before his mahout. You have to get rid of this weakness. Strive to make India strong and happy so that it may not be dependent on other countries or become vulnerable. She was once the guru of humanity. Let her assume that role again. Lead a life in such a manner that you are respected and revered as a child of Bharat, a life that will be an example and inspiration for all." Unquote. Source, Sathya Sai Speaks, Volume 23, Chapter 34. Dear listeners, happy Independence Day to our Indian listeners residing in Bharat and elsewhere, and sincere thanks to all of you out there who took the time to send in your feedback to an interview with an inspiring Bharatiya that we played last Tuesday on our Tris with Divinity segment. It was definitely a very powerful and inspiring interview, and your positive responses to it warrants a replay of this exclusive interview for those who missed it last week. And for those who have already heard it once, I know for sure you will definitely enjoy hearing it again. As a matter of fact, SAI centers around the world are playing this interview to their entire centers and in their study circle so that a maximum number of seekers benefit from it. So we launch Morning Glory today with a must-listen-to interview with Mr. Ryuko Hira of Japan. I will refrain from giving you any introductory information except to say that Mr. Ryuko Hira of Japan is a true Bharatiya or an Indian in the broadest sense as described by Baba. Now, if that sounds a bit oxymoronic to you, that is a Japanese being a Bharatiya, I prefer to let the interview speak for itself. Following the interview with Mr. Ryuko Hira of Japan, we have lined up a brand new episode of Fleeting Moments, Lasting Memories. Under the spotlight today is Sai University alumnus, Mr. K. Arun Kumar. And for your information, dear listeners, Tris with Divinity is a series of conversation with Baba's devotees from around the world, and Fleeting Moments are our interviews with the alumni of Sai schools and university. Sometimes our listeners tend to get confused between the two series, so Trist is interviews with devotees, Fleeting Moments with Sai students. With that clarified, I hope, let's get on with the Radio Sai exclusive Tris with Divinity conversation, which has proved to be quite a showstopper, evoking overwhelmingly positive response from our global listeners. Over now to an interview that is being played exclusively for your listening pleasure. Here is Mr. Ryuko Hira of Japan.
Today's episode of Trist is quite extraordinary for a number of reasons. Firstly, it explores a teacher-pupil relationship based on utter humility and implicit obedience. Our guest is a highly accomplished devotee who has consciously shied away from limelight. Despite his decades-long association with Baba, we don't generally come across his name when browsing through Sai literature. Unknown to most of us, the honored guest is listed amongst the most influential Indians around the globe. His professional success is too vast to capture in a few sound bites, and his commitment to philanthropy extends across continents. And yet, he deliberately prefers to keep as low a profile as possible and describes himself as a humble servant of Bhagwan Baba. Today his name is synonymous with the Sai movement in the country of his residence, namely Japan, where he has worked hard to create a robust Sai movement and love for Vedic learning. He has built the Sai organization and Sai centers from ground up and instituted scholarships to successfully promote Indian culture, Sanskrit language, and Vedas among the Japanese. And his passion and dedication to his master is not limited to Japan. Within the Sri Satya Sai International Organization, he has served as the overseas chairman of Zone B countries across Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, covering a total of 80 countries. Dear listeners, with us in the studio today is Mr. Ryuko Hira from Tokyo, Japan. In his professional life, Mr. Hira is the chairman of the Ora Group of Companies in Japan. He is one of the most successful Indian entrepreneurs in Japan and in the world today. Naturally, he is a leading and respected member of not only Japan's Indian community, but he is also recognized globally for his outstanding achievements both in business and charity. In the year 2010, Mr. Ryuko Hira was conferred the prestigious Pravasi Bharatiya Samman Award by the Government of India. When he is not rubbing shoulders with heads of state at the G8 summit, he is busy attending imperial functions with royalty. Interestingly, Mr. Ryuko Hira was born Kamlesh Punjabi in Jaipur, India. He graduated in gemology from the Gemological Institute of America. As a migrant to Japan, he recognized the need for proficiency in the Japanese language. Soon he completed the Japanese language studies from Sophia University, Tokyo. In the late 1970s, in order to remain competitive in the global travel and tourism industry, Mr. Hira opted for Japanese citizenship with due permission of the Indian government. Currently, he owns and operates over 50 hotels and resorts in Japan and provides management and advisory services to 90 hotels. He also runs many other businesses. Most importantly, he is deeply devoted to Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba and a committed supporter of several projects for the underprivileged in India. He is also the father of two Satya Sai students. An article published in a prestigious compilation of the world's most influential Indians described him thus, and I quote, "Hira has the characteristics of the 16th century samurai warriors who were powerful yet gentle, strong as well as kind. A samurai is always cautious, careful, prompt and accurate. Hira, with his gigantic multi-operational business empire, remains calm and composed in his actions, equally dedicated to his activities of service to mankind." Unquote. Incidentally, this extremely busy Sai samurai has also authored the book, The Study of Satya Sai. Such a deep and visionary commitment to the Sai mission definitely warrants a Trist conversation for the listening pleasure of Radio Sai Global listeners. And today I'm delighted to welcome Mr. Ryuko Hira to our studios. Sai Ram, Mr. Ryuko Hira, and a very warm welcome to Radio Sai.
Thank you very much.
I should thank you for accepting our invitation to this interview. So let's start with your journey from Jaipur to Japan that marked the evolution of Kamlesh Punjabi to Ryuko Hira. It's most fascinating, almost movie material. Now, when and under what circumstances does the chapter on Bhagwan Baba enter the story of your life?
Well, it's an old story. I don't have a good memory, but whatever little I can recall, I will place before the listeners. First of all, Sai Ram to all the listeners from Japan. Perhaps what I say may be already known. The journey to Swami in Japan was established in Kobe in 1975. And in this year of 2015, year after next, we commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Japan Sai Organization. I was in my 20s, and today I'm in my late 60s. So 15,000 days of my life, I've had the privilege of the physical presence of Bhagwan by seeing God, by listening God, and by talking to God, and by directly learning from Him the mantra to be happy. So the story begins with the Lord entering Japan through the city of Kobe.
Mm-hmm.
But what's fascinating is the word Kobe in Japanese language means God's door.
How appropriate.
So the Lord did not come to a megapolis like Tokyo, but through His door, proving to the Japanese that the avatar is the avatar. He came as God through the door. The traditional name Kobe means the door to God. So after sowing the seeds in Kobe, three pioneer Sai devotees, Brother J.T. Kupchandani, and his Chinese spouse, Sister Regina, late Brother Ram Chugani and his wife Kamla, and the present chairman of the Sai Samiti, Brother Dayal and Sister Huri, they came to Japan to introduce Sai and his teachings. I was approached by Mr. Kupchandani for my social status, and I knew nothing about Sai. And Mr. Kupchandani told me that Baba knows me, and he has asked him specially. So I told him that I have nothing to do with Baba. I do not know him. And frankly, perhaps it was all a trap. So I persistently refused to do anything for the group of Sai coming from Kobe to Tokyo. And also, frankly, I was rather busy in my work. Those were the heydays of the Japanese economy. But nevertheless, this Mr. Kupchandani was very persistent. And he convinced me that his two sons, devotees of Sai, who have been successful in business, Mr. Kishin Kupchandani from Africa and Mr. Nari Kupchandani from Indonesia. And he said, if you listen to me, you will be more successful in business. So I had some interest as a businessman to see. Well, they came to Tokyo and I invited all the Indians in Tokyo. I just said I will only provide a hall and the rest you should take care of. So they displayed the pictures and they gave a talk on Baba and they introduced the books. And for the sake of courtesy, I attended the meeting. And suddenly at the end of the meeting, when the presentation was finished, Mr. Kupchandani stands up and tells the audience that he wants to establish a Tokyo Sai Center. And without asking me, he said, I have appointed Mr. Hira as a convener. Though I objected very much and resisted, it just happened that the Indians started clapping. And out of the blue, I was unwillingly placed into this new and unknown world of Sai. In retrospect, each of my 15,000 days since I knew about Sai have been a fascinating experience, which has been revealing the infinite power of Sai's grace.
Wow. And if I may say, I think Mr. Kupchandani's prophecy that you will have greater business success did play out.
Absolutely, ma'am.
Worked for Swami and the more it played.
Yes, yes.
Now, once Baba entered into the picture, even though you accepted that role so reluctantly to be the convener for Tokyo, how did life change?
Well, frankly, it was a great mess because the change or the transformation, you know, is the only hallmark of a Sai devotee. But perhaps I was a greater sinner, so it took a longer period to change. But my observation is that the transformation of a devotee, you know, varies from a person to person. And for some, there is a very drastic change in their thinking process. Some, there is a lifestyle which is changed, and for some, there is a change of career or family. And some become, you know, very studious scholars of his teachings and so forth. So for each Sahai person, there is a different aspect of change. And Sahai chooses a special or an appropriate path which is more suitable for the person's upliftment. In my case, a tremendous transformation took place even before my very first darshan. The Kobe Center people, when they opened this Tokyo Sai Center, they said that Sai had sent a message that the old samitis must do the 12-hour bhajan for Shivaratri. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was a great nuisance to inform all the Indians in Tokyo, as there was no email, no fax. The fax system had just begun. And so we had to send a lot of post mail. I sent about 200 invitations for the very first Mahashivaratri in Tokyo, which each was costing about 80 cents, and made all the other preparations. And I knew nothing, so I asked this Kup Chandani, and he said, all you have to do is just sing the bhajans till 6 a.m. With a picture of Baba or Shiva, and you should try to fast all night. But I had no picture of Shiva in my house, and only of Satya Sai Baba, which one picture was left by Mr. Kup Chandani. Anyway, the day of Shivaratri came, and I had a busy day at office, and I came in time to find that not a single person had come to attend this Mahashivaratri bhajan in Tokyo. So I thought that they will be late in coming, and I started the prayers and bhajan. But I had never sung a bhajan in my life, and I had some experience of playing a piano, which helped me to play a few keys of the harmonium. But when I started my life's first bhajan on the Shivaratri day, and since no one came to sing, I was all alone singing and reciting continuously the same bhajan over and over again, because I knew only one or two from that book. And the voice became rather hoarse and tired, and I was told to sing continuously, so I could not go to the washroom and just stay put. Well, I looked at Sai's picture, and I told him, buddy, I can't do it anymore, because I know only these two or three bhajans, and we're going to stop it now, and I'm going to sleep. So I decided to give up and close this bhajan, and a strange thing happened. There were no push phones in those days, so the dial phones. And the telephone bell rang in my house, and it was about 8 or 10 meters to the place where the telephone was kept, so I had to walk from where I was sitting. As there was no one at home, so I picked up the phone, and I just said hello, hello on the phone, but no one answered. And suddenly, on the telephone, a very sweet and melodious bhajan begins. It goes on and on and on. And the voice was so captivating that the first time I experienced tears in my eyes, and I cried. And the bhajan was melodious, and at first I kept saying hello, thinking that, you know, it's a wrong number. And because the bhajan was so captivating that my whole body, especially the head, which was exhausted with the singing for a few hours, was recuperated like an endless tape. That bhajan went on for a long time, maybe 7, 8 minutes or 9 minutes.
Was it a male or a female voice?
Oh, it was a female voice. And it was very melodious.
Do you remember what bhajan it was?
No, madam. If I go into my old books, I intend to write a book before I die. I hope I can. But if I find, I will certainly put that. I'm sure it must be written somewhere. After it stopped, I felt very different. And I restarted the bhajan, this time with more awe rather than an obligation to Mr. Kup Chandani. As to who could have called me anyway, I was just awed by it. Anyway, the clock started to show it's 6 a.m. and I was relieved soon that I could now eat breakfast, and I realized that I don't have the picture of Shiva. So how do I finish the ceremony? And again, a strange thing happens just a little before 6 a.m. Now, not the telephone, but the doorbell rings a little before 6 a.m. And a cousin brother called Suresh N. Punjabi, he came saying that an Air India flight was stranded or delayed, and he has landed in Tokyo on his way to Osaka. which is southwest of Tokyo, and that he had brought a picture of Shirdi Sai Baba with a lingam and some snake on the picture. So we finished the bhajan and started to eat our breakfast. Of course, I was a non-vegetarian, so my usual breakfast is of eggs or ham and sausages and bacon, whatever it was. But I could not eat that morning. The body just would not accept, although I was very hungry. And the cook which does the breakfast said that you may have lost your appetite because of doing funny things of singing all night and fasting and so forth. So I just took some tea, and after that I began to smoke. I was a heavy smoker, smoking 2 or 3 cigars a day, and I would have about 2 packets of cigarettes. But as soon as I smoked, the tongue started to burn, and again a strange phenomenon took place. At lunch or dinner, also, I could not eat meat, or I could not drink alcohol or smoke. And I suddenly realized that overnight, that an internal sort of a magical transformation of lifestyle had taken place. And because of my, you know, work, professional work, usually I would eat 2 or 3 dinners in a night with different groups. My assistants would take 3 groups and I would attend each dinner 50, 60 minutes and one of the, you know, very large banquet style dinners. And with 2 or 3 dinners in the same night entertaining high level people, it's impossible to remain a vegetarian in those days. So all this lifestyle in just one night without any pain by itself, all the alcohol, all the tobacco, and all the eating of meat, fish and egg, it just stopped in one night and my whole approach to life had changed completely. This was the very first miracle that my eating and drinking, smoking lifestyle was transformed. And I began to study the first books on Baba. And the first book that I read was Loving God by Brother Kasturi, and other books which made me understand how the Baba respects India as a nation. Because though I was born as an Indian, I had no opportunity to study about India and its glory. And the first book after reading this Loving God, I could respect and serve India as a motherland. So to me, as an overseas Indian, frankly, the first experience was of the lifestyle, and the second transformation was that belief that I became a true Indian, firmly installed through his summer lectures about the glory and pride of India.
Summer course.
Yeah, and especially that Baba, he has said that India is one of the most exemplary nations of the world, and that's what attracted me to Baba the most.
Mm. And this, in the process, I believe you did go through a personal dilemma because you had to get yourself a Japanese nationality, and in the process you had to undergo change of name. And again, Baba guided you in the process. Very briefly, would you like to tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. Well, about the change of my name, it was not by my choice, but by necessity. As you know by now that I am the same age as independent free India. And in my primary and high school education, we experienced 3 wars with China and Pakistan. The British rule had not provided enough schools and universities. So even in big cities like Mumbai, where I spent my childhood, the schools were open-air outdoor schools to be shared with the street chickens or the street pigs and with the pigeons and dogs coming in and out of the class. And the rains would really drench us all. Life was miserable, and to ease the great difficulties, the Communist Party of India would go to schools, they would offer raincoats, they would offer gumboots, and they would recruit high school students as volunteers for the Communist Party. And in my own personal case, during my middle school, a veteran Hindu Indian actor called Balraj Sahni and others would come to the school on behalf of the Communist Party to recruit students. So India's political situation at that time was rather fragile. And in the high school, they had what they call the NCC, that is the National Cadet Corps. And that was focused for the high school students to join the junior army and to serve 30 days in the camps. And I was fortunate as my family had some small overseas business, which is now nearly 100 years of age. So as soon as I finished high school, the Pakistani and the Chinese wars were going on, and the ladies and the young ones at home were sent abroad for safety. So a decade later, in the 1970s, the situation in India got from bad to worse, that the government of India nationalized all the major businesses, including the banks, the insurance companies, the airlines, and others, to stabilize the nation. And major business houses and their overseas assets were also being nationalized, you see. So being a stateless refugee from Sindh family, where we lost and left everything due to the partition.
Sindh in Pakistan.
Right, right. We did not want to live in poverty again. So my eldest brother said one family member should become a Japanese national to save the family's assets from being nationalized in foreign countries. So being the youngest of five brothers, and I had some fluency in Japanese language, I was asked to become a Japanese. But having intensely read Baba's books and teachings about the supremacy of the motherland, I had great resistance to change my name and to give up my Indian nationality. But due to shortage of time, I can't put the whole story. Perhaps it's somewhere on the Japanese government site. All I recall is that I meditated intensely on Baba, whether I should change my nationality or I should not change my nationality.
On Mount Fuji, I believe.
That's right. So I went to a sacred Mount Fuji, which is incidentally last month declared by the United Nations as a World Heritage, to meditate. And I came back with the answer that a passport document or nationalization or register does not make you an Indian or another national. It is simply a matter of convenience of life. I mean, as Baba said, the true Indian is a person, Bharatiya, who carries the divine values in his heart. So I stuck to that principle. And I recalled the stories of five mothers, motherland being just one, and four others were still with me. So I finally decided to take up the Japanese nationality. But the reason for the change of name is less than 1% of Japanese population speaks English. Before the war, there was 0.1% of people who used to speak English. Because like in France, we're a very nationalistic nation.
Mm-hmm.
But in 60 years after the war, it went up 10 times from 0.1% to 1%. So when a foreign person has a Japanese nationality, they can't write his names in alphabets because our script is calligraphy-like. When you draw, which if you want to write a river, you just simply draw two banks and a water in between. So it's like kanji. These are pictorial characters is comprised in our script. So, if one had to write my name in the Japanese language, it would be very funny if it was literally translated. Like Kamalesh means the lotus, and Asia means the king of the lotus, and Punjab, then they have to write five rivers and so forth. So, it's a bit too out of place. And the bureaucratic offices, since there were no computers, and they can't write in the alphabets, we had to change the name by law. And that was very trying. So there is a Hindu temple on top of the Mount Hira in Shiga Prefecture, which is near to Kyoto, the old capital. And there's a Vishnu temple on top of that mountain. As you know, most of the Indian gods came to Japan with Lord Buddha's teachings about 1800 years ago. So that temple, there was a priest who calculated all the names of my Indian names and ancestral names, and he gave me a name called Hira Duko. Hira is the name of the mountain on which the temple stands. And Duko, Ryu means the dragon, and Ko means tiger. And the word Ryu means the dragon, as you know, has originated in the Indian mythology and then gone to the eastern countries. And Ko, tiger, the lion which sits next to Baba, it needs no definition. So the dragon represents prosperity in the Eastern culture, and the lion represents, or the tiger represents, the strength, which I don't have both. I don't have prosperity and I don't have strength. So
you're being very modest.
So perhaps that's the name.
You live up to your name. Now, as an eminent businessman and as a leading hotelier, you're in the thick of the service industry. How has knowing Baba influenced or helped you to get where you are?
And has it transformed your business practices and outlook to a more love-all, serve-all perspective? The 15,000 days that you've been with him?
Well, about the Baba's influence and how it helped me to get or where I wanted to get. Well, my belief is that Baba is the absolute and the ultimate shareholder of our business or of our empire. And every empire in the world, he is the true and ultimate owner or the shareholder. Some people realize that earlier, some realize that later. So the fortunate ones know, and the others have yet to discover. Because Baba is the owner of the business, business itself becomes a sadhana, or the business itself becomes a spiritual exercise. So to discover the divine munificence in business is the real purpose of business. That realization crumbles the ego of the greatest entrepreneur in all ages once she realizes that God, Baba, is the doer of all the achievements, which I experienced uncountable times. Whenever I had to make any important decisions, I would physically ask him, and he would guide more as master of my own business or the owner of my own business rather than as a God. So,
and all those guidances that you received, they all worked in your favor?
Well, absolutely. I just cannot describe to you a number of times. What is more important is not only the huge amount of profits that he grants, but how he protects you from the losses. One of the most impressive incidents which I physically and personally asked him, in the 1980s early, Japan was very affluent, more than now, and it was aggressively investing in foreign countries. And I have a small business of hotels, and so there was a transaction, or rather well-known throughout the world. It was called property which belonged to the Standard Chartered Bank, located at number 1 Wireless Road. It's a huge property of some 80,000 rai. And the Standard Chartered Bank was acquired by some of the Eastern people. And the bank was experiencing great difficulty, so they wanted to sell the land. And being a bank, they have to sell the land by a public auction. So I was invited in the auction. Our company was invited. The process is rather strict for very large auctions. And I was very emphatic, because the land was the prime place just near the Imperial Palace, and one cannot have it again. It's like a very precious piece of land for any development of multi-stories.
Is it in Tokyo?
No, it's in Bangkok.
Bangkok, Thailand.
Okay. Yeah, in Thailand. Mm. It's called Number 1 Wireless Road, was the name of the asset. And we were shortlisted to buy, which means amongst the first 5 people. And we took a team of about 50 people to do the analysis, and we made a bid of $800 million for just the land, because the bank had to be rescued. And after making the bid for that land, we were shortlisted amongst the best 3. So we were invited at the regional head office of the bank in Hong Kong to negotiate the details. And when I had asked Baba that I want to do this transaction, that we will be building 3 huge towers, one was a hotel, one was an office block, and one was a residential block. Each one would be about 100 stories, and perhaps one of the most impressive development. And he said, yes, you can do it. So I had great confidence, and I was proceeding full steam ahead with taking 50 people from Japan, staying there months doing the analytical work, and we came on the table to negotiate the final terms. But I was asked at that time that the monies should be paid in third countries to save taxes to the King of Thailand. And we couldn't do that because it was a very high-profile public project. So I started to pray to Baba that how come you blessed the project and I'm facing these impediments. Well, anyway, they gave us one day. There are 3 people by us to make a decision whether you would like to accept the terms of an offshore payment. The reason of offshore payment was because when the Standard Chartered Bank, as you know, Thailand was being ruled by American England, by the Allied forces, So the Standard Chartered Bank was established there for a longer time, and the book value of their land was only $1. So if they were to offer the land for sale, the entire amount would go into taxation, and the yield to the bank would be rather small. I'm talking this in due respect of morality and ethics to all my friends in the Standard Chartered Bank. It is not to bring the bank's immoral points. So when we came to the decision that we cannot bid this, much to my disappointment, the bidder was another Japanese firm which acquired. And I was very dejected, and I thought that Swami's blessings are not the right thing to be asked in business. He is more spiritual, and we shouldn't ask him about business things. So this particular person, they did this adharma of paying in the third country of offshore, and it was a huge high-profile project. All the construction was completed and opened. And after 3.5 years, the promoters were arrested for doing the adharma of the offshore payments. And not only that, 7 years later, which means 10 years when the project started, the property market in that country crashed. So the just land alone was about $700 odd million. And the 300-story buildings combined would be about $2.5 billion. Because of the Japanese boom which had contracted, the crash was so much that the value of all the assets went one-third. So this just shows that how Swami protects without asking. And when he says yes, he says yes in terms of protection, not in the human sense of greed and desire. So there is a firm belief of not to do anything in life without consulting the real owner of the business, which is God himself. So that is one of the experience, but I just want to mention that that just crumbles the ego of the greatest entrepreneur in all ages. You know, one cannot only feel or think that Baba is the owner, but one has to really practice the detachment from wealth and power. So one day...
Is it hard?
Yeah, in the beginning it is hard, but once you become habituated, it is much more easier to put the blame on Baba. Because he knows what he's doing right, and you realize, actually it's not a blame, but it's the greatest blessing. But
the responsibility is his.
Yeah. So one day Baba gave us permission, talking about his influence, to visit the overseas countries to introduce the super speciality hospital projects and later the water projects. So Brother Indulal Shah, the founder of the Satya Sai organization, myself, Dr. Sapphire and Justice Pin Bhagwati, we went to London and we made a presentation at the Wimbledon Theatre about Swami's Seva projects, talking about this detachment and Seva. So, although for first time in my life I got some kind of a standing ovation for this Baba's talk, it was only due to Swami's grace, but the work was only half done with that talk. The main point of my visit was to bring the awareness of the primary duty of detachment from wealth and for the people there to make contribution to the worthy cause of Swami's projects. But the second half was to actually see the results of the donations to implement these massive projects in those days. And I felt that I had let down Baba from my responsibility of arranging those resources for the divine projects, because all the people, they listened to the talks, but they were not, you know, being detached and sending as much as they should or they could. So I was depressed. And I consulted my wife that what shall we do? And I said, we should sell our house in Tokyo and do our duty to Bhagawan, because he has given us the responsibility to go there and talk. So I took the estimates of the most reputed real estate agent, and they said that the minimum price if we could sell our house would be about $20 million. So I flew to Baba, and he was most gracious to call me for an interview. I told him, Swami, that I have failed in my duty of putting enough of the resources from other parts of the world, and people have not made their contributions. So I have decided to sell my house, and we will transfer the money for the divine projects of the hospital or whatever it was. Then Baba looked into my eyes, and with the greatest ease, he told me, do not sell your house. Then he said a statement which in his words, he says, which mother will allow her son to stay in a rented house?
Uh-huh.
So we see here that those who surrender everything to Bhagavan, for them, wealth is only a spiritual tool of divine seva. So also the other lesson of the business being influenced by Baba is that Bhagavan does not want anyone's resources.
How do you say that when all the projects that are run here for humanitarian purposes are fueled and funded by donations from devotees?
Yes, he does not want their donations or he does not want their resources. He is only a giver, he never takes. And he said once in the interview room, if Bhagavan wills, there will be a rain of rupees. These are his words. So we see that Baba's main message is complete and absolute detachment has to be learnt and practiced by every businessman by keeping all the financial, human and technical and other resources at the divine lotus feet. When he says, when he takes a project, he does not depend on anybody's donations or anyone's contributions, because he knows that what is going to happen and before he takes. But as you know, which is a well-known story most of you must be knowing, he used to talk very frequently to move people to detachment, to sacrifice, to tyaga, for contributing to these various humanitarian projects. One day we were sitting just outside his room and a school student gave him a letter. So he asked the student, may I open this letter and read to everybody? But the student was very shy. Swami opened the letter and read, and it is in the formal discourse also. The boy's letter said, O Bhagavan, every day you are giving discourses that people should make contributions of sacrifice and detachment. I am from Calcutta and my mother sends me 100 rupees to pay to the dhobi to wash the clothes in school. However, I cannot donate money because I come from a poor family. Mm. I will start washing these clothes by myself, and if you can buy one brick with those 100 rupees and put in that, I have done my seva or my duty to listening to Baba. A child has written that. So we see the purpose of Swami informing the projects to people is not at all to collect donations. God never takes, he only gives. He is absolute, you see. So it is only the humanitarian projects are the process to the people of detachment. And he gave a great message about the definition of detachment. He says, what is attachment and detachment? He said that deep attachment to God is detachment. So we see the only influence of Swami in business is to surrender that the business belongs to him. He is the chairman and the shareholder, and we're just his humble servants, and to continue working in his teachings.
Including following ethics where you lost such a huge deal in Thailand,
yes,
for example.
Yes, yes.
In the process you gained, because you would have been a victim of the huge loss.
Yeah, well, I would be on the streets.
Such a huge loss. I understand. Sir, a person of your means can easily educate his children in the most prestigious of private schools anywhere in the world. Now, your daughter has studied in Baba's school in Prashanthi Nilayam, and your son continues to be a Baba student, a Sai student in Puttaparthi. Would you like to explain your choice to our listeners?
Well, why I chose the Sathya Sai school? You have put 2 points in your question. One is there are so many prestigious schools in the world. The other is why I chose.
Because your children can be studying their royalty studies.
Yes, well, the educational institutions of Bhagwan are the most prestigious, rather the only prestigious schools in the whole world. The prestige of a school is comprised by academic standards, or it is sports standards, or by standards of character building. If the Sai schools were to participate in the grading process, or the global grading process of the world's best institutions, they will all have a global standard which will be the highest. So I have seen, I have experienced, and I have worked myself to receive my own satisfaction, and I'm convinced that the Sai School is the world's most prestigious school.
I feel like clapping to that, because I completely agree with that. I thought I was the only enthusiast.
Well, you see, the significance of the Sai School, each teacher, as you know, is a guru in the true sense. I mean, of removing the darkness, the ignorance. So the guru delivers the child the illumination of wisdom. So we see that the present Satya Sai Schools, Bhagawan has chosen teachers of no less caliber. You know, they are saints in trousers.
And saris.
Yeah, and saris, please pardon me. But Bhagawan has chosen the world's best teachers to be the gurus in his institutions. Baba has chosen today those teachers who will have the privilege to carry his mission, you see. So we see the teachers continue even today in that same tradition, and I'm sure this will continue forever in the Sai schools, because that is his sankalpa. Also we have the example of the sage Valmiki. So he was a transformed teacher, and who taught the Ramayana to the divine children of Mother Sita, the Lava and Kusha. And later, Lava and Kusha, they sang the divine story of Ramayana during the Ashwamedha Yagna congregation. And at that time, Lord Sri Ramachandra confirmed what was sung by these two children is true. Even today, all the Sai students sing and extol the glory of Avatar. So there is no difference between the Valmiki, the Vashishta and Sandipani and the present Sai schools. There is no difference. The only difference is that it is happening in the present age and we are able to witness this. But somebody has to academically study the process and analyze and scholastically put it in that framework. Then we have the similarity of the Sai teachers who resemble the highest ideals of the iconic teacher, sage Vashishta. We see the ideal teachers of Lord Rama. And when we see sage Vashishta, he has established the system of Gurukula, starts from him, the residential college, on the banks of river Beas, and he was taking care of thousands of students in those days. So today, Sai schools are similarly located on the holiest of the river Chitravati. And each principal of the school is a sage who has undergone the penance of surrendering their entire lives, 24 hours, 365 days, only for the welfare of Sai children. The Sai principals and the teachers have done more than the parents can do. They have surrendered their entire lives. So I have no question in my mind that I have done the best choice, and this will continue till I am able to deliver my promise to Swami that the first Japanese citizens to become Sai students, my children. I had prayed to Bhagavan that they will do the seva of bringing the Sai ideal education to Japanese schools. It may take another 30 or 40 years. But I have chosen that school for my children because I prayed intensely to Baba for 8 years to please accept them. And for 8 years, he couldn't accept them. And after he blessed them with this highest boon one can get is to become a Sai student. And also I'm quite sure that for my own personal reasons about not choosing a Japanese school. Because as you know, Japan was defeated in the Second War. And General MacArthur wrote the new Japanese constitution, which we have today, which prohibits spiritual or religious education. Even the Japanese public schools, they cannot learn about their own spiritual or religious values. This was done to maintain the supremacy over a defeated nation by suppressing the nationalism, you see, national values or epics and ethos. So the Shinto and the Buddhist and other religions were prohibited from the syllabus in the consequence, you know, very scholastic, very materialistic Japanese society with no spiritual base in the educational system. Of course, there were excellent private schools which I could have sent to Christian schools, Buddhist or the Shinto faiths, but there is nothing to match the requirement of an ideal Indian school. So we prayed to Bhagawan and he granted our boon.
Beautiful to hear that from a parent of a Satya Sai student. actually two students. Now your family is very committed to Bhagwan, and your wife, Mrs. Kayoko Hira, she heads the Institute of Satyasai Education. All this work is very time consuming. It requires deep commitment, as does, I'm sure, your vast business empire. Where do the Hiras draw their inspiration from, and how do they manage their time to get so much done? You're all a family of overachievers.
Well, I think I don't fit that comment of yours, but about how to draw inspiration is, you know, the very word inspire is the motivation of the inner spirit, as you know, the inner aspirations. The secret of finding time and deep commitment comes from the Jyoti meditation. The Dhyana Vahini is the theory of success, because without concentration you cannot take one step in life. So the Dhyana Vahini is the theory of success, which helps every entrepreneur.
So do you practice Jyoti meditation every day?
Yes, madam. And this Jyoti meditation is for three things it gives: the breath, the thought, and the time. So when we do Jyoti meditation, the life source of our breath is regulated, which involuntarily controls the thought process. And it brings a tremendous speed of action, which saves a lot of time that can be used for Sai Seva. So the simplest theories of Bhagwan grant infinite rewards. And, there are seven steps which are put. The first is the environment. The breath comes from the environment. So if you're in a good environment, good thoughts come. So he said satsang all the time, be in good place. Then the breath itself, which conveys the thoughts. Mm-hmm. And the thoughts themselves lead to the so-called willpower, the Ichcha Shakti, to do something. And from that Ichcha, we come to the Kriya Shakti, do the actual action power. And from that, our habit or character is formed. And that habit or character decides the destiny of man, you see. So in these seven processes of this Dhyana Vahini, you come in business especially, it's one of the most handy tools and the easiest to take care of.
And that's the best analysis of spirituality in business that I have heard. Very nicely said. And it's amazing to hear it from a person who actually practices it.
Well, I still have to go a long way. I'm still greedy in spirituality, but it's just one step.
It's a good greed to have, spiritual greed, I guess. Now, let's talk about this interview that you had with Baba one time. And Swami told you specifically that youth is very important, and he gave you three ideals for a youth: respect for parents, respect for teachers, and respect for elders. And he said this is very important. This led you to explore Baba's childhood history. What can you share about that incident?
Well, there was no youth wing in the overseas Sai organization at that time. We had no youth wing. Till we started first in the Asian Sai centers, and later in the other countries joined. So we organized the first international youth conference, and the proceedings are all recorded. I mean, not Bhagwan's divine discourses, I mean the proceedings of the youth conference. And a number of youth schemes were started, which made a U-turn, and later on those schemes, U-turn in the sense they were later on adopted by Indian Sai Samitis. So I believe the best way to see Swami's reaction for a youth program was to deliver Baba's very own lifestyle as a youth. So very little was known about his youth, especially in English language at that time. So I asked Swami for three things. First was that I want to do the first ever exhibition on the theme of Mother Ishwarama. And this exhibition was held at Whitefield in Bangalore, which he inaugurated with his divine hands. And the second was to pray to him to accept the life-size photo paintings of Mother Ishwarama and Father Venkataraja, which he blessed and decorated in the main hall of the Trai Mandir. And the last permission which we asked him was to have the first international youth conference. So after this youth conference, I realized there was a tremendous need by the youth to see Baba's actual youth behavior. Mm-hmm. And I decided to make the first ever live stage drama play on his youth. And I went to pray and seek his permission. And he said, no, Hira, no. He first said no. Because I guessed the reason he's saying no, it may not be to his highest standards and expectations. Nobody can play the youth of Sai. Mm-hmm. And we can't expect Baba to watch the rehearsals. But he said no. But I was very adamant and rather persistent. So I continued to pray and I fasted till he will permit. On the last day of departure, he called finally. And he said, Japan, come inside. So we went inside. And he asked about, what is this fasting about the play? So he put several strict conditions. He said, if I allow you, I have to allow everybody. I said, Swami, that is your business. Mm-hmm. Whom you allow, whom you don't, because you know who can do what, who cannot do what. So he put several strict conditions. The first was that he said, not the youth of Sai, but the childhood of Sai.
Okay.
Then he said, keep it as Bala Sai only during his school days.
Okay.
This was very difficult because very little was known of the school days. So we collected and interviewed as much as we could to enact the first play because it had to be in perfection, you see. Which was by his grace finally most successful. And he materialized several things for the actors. And all the rules of Baba were maintained that all were girls who were dressed as his boys. And the name of the play was Raju that we had put. And after this, I prayed to him for the Sai youth to be allowed to do the play on Ishwarama, the first play. He said, because many people told me when Baba is living, you cannot have a play on him. So in that Ishwarama, we could bring... I wanted to go the other way around when you said that you cannot bring a youth. If I bring Ishwarama, he will allow to bring the youth, you see. So this play where we show that how he lived with Mother Ishwarama and the three ideals of respecting parents, teachers and elders. And this play was held in the Kalyan Mandap in the Trayi. And after the play was finished, Bhagwan stood in the hall for a long time. He blessed all the few hundred devotees from Japan. He was immensely pleased. When I escorted him back to the Trayi Mandir, he said that the actor, the Japanese actor, he was so good that I'm afraid the people will think that he's real Sai and they may go to worship him instead of me. These are the words he mentioned.
Wow.
And so the play Raju is the script of the Swami's childhood days book that I mentioned.
Beautiful. And you went about it so methodically doing your research. First of all, fasting to get your way with him.
Yeah, because it's not easy to please unless there is a very firm determination. If people are half-hearted and if he gives permission, then, you know, God can be very chaotic. So he has his own standards of granting permission, which only he knows.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brother Hira, you've had such a history of association with Swami. If you go down memory lane, what are your fondest memories of His Divine Grace, His intervention, your interactions, just the fondest ones that come from your heart, anything you recall?
Well, He's always there when you want Him. That is the fondest memory. There was a time there were no Balvikas school teachers in Japan, and I couldn't learn or pronounce Hindi properly. But I have to learn as a teacher first before I can teach. The southernmost island of Japan was Okinawa, which was 2.5 hours flying time. And the students said they want to have a class every week without a teacher. So I used to go every week flying 2.5 hours back and forth to teach over
there. Incredible commitment.
And then on the ending of the class, he showers all the students with the vibhuti. But one of the most memorable incidences is that there was a Japanese devotee, a young boy, he's dead now. His name was Mr. Hoshino from Kobe and Osaka. The vibhuti of about 3.5 inches appeared on the whole picture of Baba, the full picture of the Abhaya Hasta. But this vibhuti was different from any other vibhutis, that the color of the vibhuti was golden color. We had never seen. So I brought the sample of the photo and the actual vibhuti, and I was fortunate when he called in the interview room. I asked him, Swami, why is this vibhuti golden? And he said, silver devotion, silver vibhuti, golden devotion, golden vibhuti.
so beautiful. My God. I've never heard that before. This was at your Bal Vikas class?
No, this is Mr. Hoshino's photograph.
And 3.5 inch thick, huh?
Yeah, and we distributed the calendar, pocket calendar photographs of that about 35 years ago in Prashanti Nilayam at that time.
Golden Vibhuti. Wow. And personally, he must have spoken to you and your family many, many times.
Well, the last few years, he was most gracious. He would call home for dinner at every visit.
To Yajur Mandir?
Yes, and always he would give very graciously the time for spiritual advice and what to do for the organization and so forth. But we are not supposed to, you know, talk about these personal interactions.
I see. Anything that was generic that listeners can draw inspiration from and learn from?
Yes, he was always concerned about the work which was going on, the Sai work in the respective countries. The key point was that he mentioned once that when a child is born, the mother and father prepare everything from the cradle to the toys, his clothes, and they make plans for his studies, and they have hopes. He said, do you think when God is born that no plans are made when he comes on earth? So he said that all the Sai organization people, including the one who has yet to join, are a part of the great divine master plan. We may be aware of that or we may be unaware of that. And therefore, once that awareness comes that we are a part of the divine, we are his hands, we are his feet, we are his fingers, and we are his eyes, then the concept changes. And then he intervenes himself, because the question was of divine interventions. So when I would visit the Bal Vikas class, if I couldn't pronounce the Hindi words, he would just, at that nick of the moment, bring the words which I had never learnt in my life, you see. So I have many times experienced about the divine interventions.
Beautiful. My God. Now, just a hypothetical question. If you had just one moment to interface physically with Bhagwan right now, what would you say to him?
Well, I think silence is what he prefers usually, without saying anything, just to see his form, because there has been no avatar who has given his feet to the public. So if he was to appear physically, I would just ask for his divine lotus feet, nothing else.
Do you long for the physical form?
Yes.
So beautiful, wasn't it? Yeah. Baba's Mahasamadhi, what does it mean to you, sir?
I think the samadhi is the symbol of detachment from the body. And it is a symbol of the great awareness of one's own self.
You've been so keenly involved in the growth of the Sai movement. In your opinion, what's the future of this movement in the physical absence of the avatar?
Well, I think the Sai organization is still in the evolutionary process. Like man's very own physical evolution took a long time. When he said the organization will live for 1,000 years, it's only evolved for 50 years. So it's 0.5%. The evolution of 99.5% has yet to be evolved. Therefore, the good visions and the good dreams of the leaders, Sai leaders, will all be realized with Swami's guidance and inspiration. I think the future of the Sai organization is one that will be only force that can lead the world, which is required. And as time passes by, we will see that will happen more rapidly than most people expect it to happen.
What are our challenges, though, in this process?
Well, I think in the true sense, being a divine organization, there are really no challenges at the moment. The challenges are just an illusion of the people there. A divine organization of the Satya Sai has no challenges. But if one has to see, I think the biggest challenge of the Sai organization is the ignorance of the self. We must have a very clear short, long and medium term planning, which is already in place. But still, Baba doesn't want, as you know, any numbers. He has always talked about high quality. And therefore the evolution will be very slow, but it will be in perfection. And in that sense, because it is slow, there are many people who are unable to catch with that slow lifestyle because it's a fast world at the moment. So I think that's one of the challenges.
Because subtlety is hard to catch for some people who are at a different level. Now, you kept saying earlier, you mentioned that Baba's way will come to the forefront more rapidly, more sooner than most people imagine. Why is this message so important in today's world?
Well, we see that the population has grown to 6 billion and all the world institutions are showing that it will reach 10 billion. More people, more thoughts, and more thoughts require more clarity. So the purpose of the Sai Avatar is to simplify, to decode the divine message of the Vedam, because he is the Veda Avatar himself. So I think the relevance of the Sai Avatar has just begun in global terms. Now when we take a view of the 6 billion people, and when we have a comparative study of the avatars, we look at Lord Christ, we look at Lord Buddha. The Christianity, the first Bible came 500 years after Lord Christ. So we are nowhere near in terms of time frame. It is just so recent and what he has left. And in case of Lord Buddha, it reached Japan 700 years after he left
the body.
So we can see his message is so eternal that it will bring, there is a need which will bring the change.
Finally, who is Bhagwan Sri Satyasai Baba for you?
Well, you got me a very difficult one right at the spur of the moment. I really don't know. I still have to find out, I believe, because to find a word that befits his glory is beyond human description. Human beings cannot describe who is Satyasai Baba. It's impossible for me to describe his glory, you see.
And this is coming from a person who has had so much of physical, direct, close contact with him. So did you at times feel you were interacting with an enigma? You had no idea who he was?
Yes, I think at times he's a father, at times he's mother, at times he's a friend, at times he's God, at times he's a very strict teacher. So he has various roles he plays in life, but one cannot describe him.
Just as the Vedas say, it's hard to capture. Your final thoughts, your final words for the listeners of Radio Sai all over the world.
Well, I would like them all to visit Japan and to see Sai's glory as much as possible and as soon as possible.
We hope that happens soon. Thank you so very much for joining us today. Really, really deeply appreciate you sparing the time for this interview, sir.
Great pleasure, ma'am.
Sai Ram.
Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, and welcome back to Morning Glory, coming to you live from Prashanthi Nilayam, India, the seat of all things true, auspicious and beautiful. The time right now in Prashanthi Nilayam, India is 10:52 a.m. Today is 15th of August, 2013. You just heard an interview with Mr. Ryuko Hira of Japan. It would be wonderful to have your feedback to this conversation. Please do share your thoughts on this episode of Trist with Divinity that was played specially for you on Morning Glory today. You can send in your emails to listener@radiosai.org. Now, here's an important reminder from Bhagwan Baba. He says, only when morality is upheld, there can be equality, fraternity and freedom in society. This is such an important thought to reflect upon on India's 67th Independence Day. Now moving along, it is time now for a brand new episode of Fleeting Moments, Lasting Memories, our series of conversations with Baba students, that is the alumni of Sai schools and university. And today, we have Mr. K. Arun Kumar in conversation with Radio Sai's Bishu Prushti. This interview is a four-part conversation, and starting today, I will bring you all four parts over the coming weeks right here on Morning Glory. So please stay with us. Over now to Brother K. Arun Kumar.
Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to Fleeting Moments, Lasting Memories, our series of conversations with former students of Bhagwan's educational institutions, and today our guest in the studios is Brother K. Arun Kumar. It is really interesting that we are having this conversation, and I will tell you in a while why it is so. Arun hails from Visakhapatnam, Andhra Pradesh, and after his schooling in that city, he did his graduation in civil engineering in IIT Kharagpur. The IITs, as many would know, are the premier institutions to do engineering in India. It was after this degree that he stepped into Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning in the year 1999 for his management degree. In 2001, he completed his MBA, and after this, I should say, started another glorious phase of his life. He had the most blessed and privileged opportunity of serving Swami at very close quarters for all those years between 2001 and 2005. In fact, if you remember visiting Prashantilayam during that period, you must have seen him walking behind Swami, ready to assist Bhagwan in any way Swami wishes. In fact, it was during this period that Swami also gave him the opportunity of serving in Radio Sai. Yes, in fact, he is one of the early direct recruits of Swami to Radio Sai. And I said that this is really an interesting occasion, because what I am doing now is what he was doing 7-8 years ago. He had the privilege of taking direct instructions from Swami and contributing immensely in those initial years of Radio Sai. And today, he is here in Prashantinilam again for Radio Sai work. In fact, today is July 14, 2013, and since morning we are having live programs in our Telugu stream to commemorate the second anniversary of this stream. As per Bhagwan's command, the Telugu stream started during Guru Purnima celebrations in 2011, and it is 2 years since then. Acceding to my request, Arun is here with me now to share about his indelible moments with Bhagwan, his training that he received at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and of course, his fond recollections of being a part of the Radio Sai team then. He currently lives and works in Hyderabad and is involved in the activities of the Sai organization there. In fact, he has to leave in 2 hours from now. So, welcome Arun, and I really thank Bhagwan that he has made it possible that we are having this conversation now. You are able to take some time out.
Thank you.
And be with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Vishu. It's been really a great homecoming for me to have come back and participated in this wonderful program. For any student of Swami who comes here, I can bet that although their bodies leave the portal, their soul always remains in this place, because this is where they got the greatest lessons of their life, and this is where those fleeting moments have been converted into lasting memories which are serving us for the rest of our life and for generations to come. So it's been great seeing all the people here. Some of us worked together, and some of the boys are new boys, but it's been a great progress, and the way everything is being orchestrated by Swami, in the way in which the media, the digital media, the web, everything is being flooded in this age of internet where you can find all sorts of information. I think this is a great oasis in the digital world where everybody can partake of the avatar's glorious mission.
Yes, exactly. In fact, you perhaps also remember the feedback that you were receiving then, and we continue to receive such feedback even now, saying that,
absolutely,
you know, this
amazing
is one website, this is one place where we feel that the internet is being put to such good use.
Exactly, exactly. I think those messages, more than anything, when the readers and the listeners come back to you, and, you know, I remember so many messages coming back, it was, they used to communicate that such and such a talk or such and such an article has transformed their lives, but every message that we read, you know, personally, it transformed my life, because we just realized what is the impact of Swami's message, how deep and how lasting its effects can be. It was wonderful, and I'm really glad to have come back on this day, and I'm really thankful that all of you remembered me, and, you know.
Come on. You are so much a part of Radio Sai, and we can never ever forget how you were so fortunate in those initial years to be part of the Radio Sai team.
Yeah, yes.
And there are so many things coming in my mind now what to ask you, because I'm really very eager to know about those initial days of Radio Sai.
Yes.
Because you were there when Bhagwan came to the studio and inaugurated the studio.
Correct. Yes.
And also you had those amazing years with Bhagwan. So let us begin from where it all started.
Yeah.
And then we'll come here. I will have to hold my eagerness. But perhaps it'll all fall in place.
Yes.
If we come through this chronology.
Definitely. Yes.
So tell us, how did you happen to become a student in the first place? Did you have the dream to become a student, or just you realized that you were in the institute one day?
Well, to be honest, it was my dream.
Okay.
And literally also, there was a dream.
Oh, fantastic.
So, you're actually factually correct when you say it was my dream. But anyway, I think let me begin by giving a brief background that from my childhood, for me, Bhagwan has been a de facto God.
Mm-hmm.
Because I used to see Bhagwan's portrait in our puja room, which my parents had kept.
So, this is like from the time you...
From the time...
You were aware.
Yeah, from the time I'm aware. So, the moment I saw Bhagwan's picture, I just thought he was God and nobody...
Because your parents told you?
They didn't even tell me. They just put the picture in the altar along with all the other gods.
So it was there.
So it was, you know, by comparison, you know. So all these are gods.
Yes.
And I didn't even know that Swami was walking on earth.
Oh, okay. So you thought he is someone like Ramakrishna.
Yeah, I thought so. And slowly when I was growing up, one of my aunts, who was one of our close relatives, who were actually staying in Jamshedpur in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
They were great devotees of the Lord. And it was one day that suddenly my aunt shared all her experiences and their family's experiences. And it kind of blew me away. It laid the foundation for me that, hey, this is something great. And so
how old were you then? Which class were you then?
I was probably in my 5th or 6th standard. So,
sometime in the 80s.
Yeah, sometime in the 80s. Late 80s maybe. So, that was when I really came to know about Swami, and I came to know that Swami was a living entity. Also, during the same time, when I used to ask my dad to tell me some stories, he used to tell me the story of how Swami would go on to the Kalpavruksha.
Yes.
And ask people, what do you want? And Swami would pluck out the fruit of their choice.
Yes.
So that he kind of told me in a slightly appealing way, saying, you know, Swami would pluck out chocolate or Swami would pluck out ice cream.
So that
would
really fascinate
me. Yeah, that really fascinated me. And that is the only thing my father ever told me about Swami. But that kind of went deep into my heart, that Swami was. And there were several influences in my school just at the same time when I was getting to know Swami. And now I see all that back and I feel that, you know, Swami had kind of planned and sent me information about him from all channels, from my relatives. And in school, I was a student who was involved in extracurricular activities and I was getting a lot of prizes and awards in the debates and elocutions, etc., etc. And one of the teachers, one of my teachers, we used to call him CLN sir, he was a great devotee of Swami. We never knew about it. But what
this is not the Sai school in Vishakhapatnam.
No, this is a Sri Krishna Vidya Mandir. It's one of the schools run by the RSS.
Okay. Rashtriya Swayam
Sevak Sangh. Yeah.
Yes.
And
a lot of emphasis on Indian culture.
And once in a while, the school principal used to tell our school should become like the Puttaparthi school.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
So, comparisons were being made, actually. Now, coming back to our teacher, our English teacher, whenever I won a prize, he, instead of gifting me some trophy or some cup or some medal, he always used to gift Swami's books.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the competitions I got Gita Vahini and another competition I got Satyam Shivam Sundaram, all in English.
Mm.
And I started reading them and I started knowing about Swami. So, that's how my interest in Swami grew. So, I chanced upon the book My Baba and I by Hislop. That book completely blew me away. you know, every page was like mesmerizing and
yes.
It was totally, I
the
couldn't
first
believe.
The 150 yeah. pages are filled with amazing
events. Amazing events and the whole story of how Swami materialized the crucifix.
Yes.
And how the storm had come and so many other experiences. It was totally incredible. I think for the next 2 or 3 days I couldn't sleep. I said, this is a great phenomenon and I need to meet this person. And that was when I firmly decided and I started thinking of getting into Swami's institutes. But then I think by the time I was in my plus two and
11th and 12th.
Yeah, 11th and 12th. And one day somebody took me to the Sat Sai Mandir in Vishakhapatnam. It's a beautiful place. And I attended the bhajan. And it was a very, very thrilling experience. The music and the fervor with which the boys had sung. So, without my knowledge, I was kind of drawn into the Swami's fold. My thoughts were always revolving around Swami. And I was thinking, what will it be if I meet this person? You know, how will it be? And what would he say to me? It was kind of infatuated with the concept of Swami.
Such a person is, if he's actually living.
Yes, that's what, that first of all, it's so unbelievable and now he's walking on earth. So, I couldn't take my mind off him. And that was in my plus two. And of course, with all the competition, everything, I was preparing hard for the IIT exam. And,
So you didn't think of joining here for graduation at that time?
No, I didn't. I always wanted to get into the IITs.
IITs, that was another dream.
Yeah, so I was like, I worked very hard and at the same time, I was reading a lot of Swami's books. At the same time, I was reading a lot of stuff for the IIT and I used to read a lot in the nights and do a lot of night outs with my friends and, you know, until 6 o'clock in the morning, then drink some coffee, have some breakfast and sleep, again get up in the afternoon. It was a very perverted schedule, I should say, in the sense that we were all slogging out in the nights. So my first experience came when one morning when I was sleeping, I suddenly saw Swami in a white robe in my dream. And Swami was in his Abhayahasta. And I believe he was standing near the Ganesha, which used to be there in the Prashanthi Nilayam, in the
Ganesha and the Sai Kulwant Hall?
Kulwant Hall.
Sai
yeah,
Kulwant Hall.
Kulwant Hall.
Yeah.
So Swami was there and he just said, Ratri Poota Ekkuga Chadavuku Bangaru Arogyam Padavutundi. That is in Telugu. Which means that don't study too much in the nights. It will spoil your health.
Oh my God.
So
this is the first time he is
that
coming
was
in your
the first
dream.
Time. I didn't even knew that he came in the dream. And I just caught up with a startled feeling and it was a very, very pleasant and blissful feeling. I didn't know for what, but it was like, it was great. And I was able to recollect the dream like it was a live experience. So I continued to think about it. But then after some time, you know, I thought maybe it's my imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So I just left it like that. And by the time I had subscribed for Sanatana Saradhi, I thought I should start reading Swami's message. So when I received my first copy of Sanatana Saradhi just a few days after this dream, I just opened the Sanatana Saradhi and there was a speech of Swami in the first page where Swami was addressing the students. And in the first page, my eyes immediately fell on a paragraph in which Swami says, students should not study too much in the night. It will spoil their health and it is only demons who stay awake in the night. And it was very startling to me that here was this, few days back I saw Swami in my dream and he was saying the same thing.
Very clear dream.
Very clear. And now I get it as if, you know, you don't believe some things if it's not written, like an agreement. So it came on print and the message was unmistakable. It was for real. And he was telling me that this is my message to you. That was my first experience of Swami.
Just trying to confirm.
Confirm, yeah. So that kind of established my faith and I was yearning for more and more such experiences. So it continued and my involvement with the Sai movement and I voraciously read the books of Swami.
Mm-hmm.
There was a small library in the Sat Sai Mandir at Vishakhapatnam. and CLN sir, who was presenting Ms. Swami's books, was the honorary librarian there.
Okay.
So one day he called me and he said, Arun, I am going out of station for a week and I need somebody to manage the library. So would you be able to manage it? I said, okay. And then I took over the library for a week. In the evening, people would come and borrow books. And more than giving books to people, I had a chance to voraciously read and lap up so many books of Swami in that 1 week. I read so many books about Swami, and it was amazing.
That was a huge blessing.
Huge blessing. And I think it was arranged by Swami.
Yes.
And so now I started dreaming about getting into Swami's institute. But anyway, Swami was kind enough to bless me with a seat in the IITs. And I went into the IIT for the 4 years and had a good time. There also, in a very miraculous way, I met so many people, so many professors who were all Swami's devotees. So they became my IIT, yes. They became my local guardians. And I used to attend bhajans. Every day there used to be a bhajan in IIT.
Every day?
Every day in somebody's house. In the campus. In the campus. A lot of professors from different states, they used to have bhajans. So I used to go, I used to sing, we used to go and do service. So throughout my engineering, I was totally involved with the Sai movement. You know, the Sarvadharma Stupa, which was constructed by Brigadier S.K. Bose.
Yes.
He was the director of IIT Kharagpur.
Oh, at that time when you...
Before that. But because of his legacy, all the professors who joined in the campus then, they all got introduced to Swami and the movement continued. There's a lot of following for Swami in West Bengal. Amazing. It's so invisible, but it's so totally spread out. And it was amazing. So throughout the IIT years, I think the influence of Swami made sure that I didn't really fall prey to the regular waywardness of the engineering students. Because, you know, when people, usually students, find freedom suddenly, there was a lot of people who were going into the wrong ways. But luckily for me, because of Bhagwan's grace, I was tightly holding on to the Sai group instead of socializing with the wrong groups. And it kind of helped me to overcome my teenage years without getting into the, I would say, the wrong ways of adulthood or adolescence.
Yes.
So I finished my engineering and then I joined in one public sector undertaking called Engineers India Limited. Mm-hmm. So I worked for 1 year after my engineering.
Okay.
And it was that time I had a dream again.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami was in an auditorium. He was sitting in an auditorium and I was sitting next to him. And I asked Swami, Swami, I want to study in your institute. Swami said, yes. And then I asked him, Swami, I want to work in your institute. Swami said, tappakunda, yes. So that was a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended. But I had a habit of writing down all my dreams so that I don't forget. So I wrote this dream down. So that was an assurance given by Swami that I would study and I would work in his institute. And later on, at the same time, I was preparing for getting into IIM. You know, the natural trajectory
yes.
for an IIT student is to get into an IIM. So I was preparing very hard for IIM. At the same time, I was having my eye on Swami's MBA also in Swami's institute. So again, one night, Swami comes into my dream and tells me, why are you preparing for IIM? You will not get it.
Oh my God.
So I took it as a challenge. Aray, how come Swami is telling me I will not get it? But then by a strange twist of things, although I prepared very well, I couldn't clear IIM.
So you did right then.
I did go to the exam and the exam center was St. Anne's Girls' School.
Mm-hmm.
Girls' School or Girls' College in Hyderabad.
Mm-hmm.
And I went inside. I sat in the hall. And after I sat in the hall, I had the urge to go and ease myself out.
Mm.
And I asked the examiner to let me out. He said, we don't usually allow people to go out, but you have to come back in a few minutes. And I went out. It being a girls' school, I couldn't really find a place which I can use. And so because I had a time limit, I came back. and I wanted to write the exam, but this whole urge for the
predicament.
So it totally distracted my mind and I couldn't write anything.
Oh,
and I
my
just
God.
Walked out of the exam.
So that,
after some time.
That was how your IIM entrance went.
Yeah, that was how. And oh, although I prepared very well, I couldn't answer anything.
You don't know anything can happen.
Yeah. So I just came back and I came for Swami's college entrance. And
Swami told you, you're not going to clear
yeah,
that.
He told me.
He made you learn about it the hard way.
He made sure that although you can prepare well, there are other ways I can make sure that you don't get through. At least that's my belief. So I came back here to Satsai Institute and I wrote the exam and I prayed hard to Swami that I should get in, and it was a great moment for me when my name was displayed on the next day that I have been selected in the written, and there was a group discussion. So finally, I think very quickly, I came to know that in a few days that I got selected. Mm-hmm. So that was the beginning of my journey with Swami, and I think the whole crucible where my life was about to be totally changed and transformed. So, yeah, it was a dream, and it was literally a dream, and the dream came true.
Fantastic. You said this was a place where your life completely transformed, but from what you said till now, you were into Swami all the time, and you were into trying to lead a life the kind that Swami expects. You know, even in engineering days, you didn't get into the wrong ways. And so you are so much, you have read so much about Swami. So you are actually almost in this wavelength. What really happened that, you know, you are saying that your life changed dramatically?
Yeah. Of course, I was in the wavelength, but it was all intellectual. It was at the level of what Swami calls bookish knowledge, you know. But I think Swami's message is very simple. And the most important thing that people are not able to practice is the art of being happy. Always. Cheerful. I think that is, according to me, Swami's most important. And all your bookish knowledge, all your intellectual knowledge, all your knowledge of Swami's teachings, message, everything is of no consequence if this is what Swami has come to do. He wants to make us all happy, be cheerful and make everybody else happy. So, to put it very simply, I learned the art of being happy when I came to Swami.
That's fantastic. In fact, the moment you mention about spirituality, especially to teenagers of these times, you know, the immediate thought that comes is a very dry thing. You know, it's meant for all those guys who have renounced everything. There is no fun there. And you're not going to have all this color in life. And it's
going to be
a very sorry statement. You're not really making the most of your life. That's the kind of feeling that you get, right?
Correct.
Most of the time.
Right.
People outside, especially teenagers.
Yes.
You feel, that's why you just shut yourself off. I want to enjoy life. You know, you don't talk to me about spirituality.
Yeah.
But here you are telling me that spirituality, you learned the art of being happy.
Yes. In fact,
so spirituality was fun for you.
Exactly. In fact, you got it right. He made life a great deal of real thrill and joy and fun. And when I came here, I realized that life can be so much buzzing with energy, and the way the institute and the whole system has been framed here, it gave great vent to your creativity. And he was always for action, and, you know, he wanted his students to be live wires. He wanted us to be happy. That's what he said. I've come here to make you happy. That's his simple message.
So you saw here how, even though it's a completely spiritual environment, but there is so much of energy and there is so much activity and there is so much fun.
There was so much fun, there was so much activity, and I think this is the hostel that we stayed was the best hostel that you can ever get. You know?
You have stayed in IIT hostel before.
Of course I stayed. I had a single room, I had a cot for myself, but it was not something that really added value to my life. But here, I was sleeping on the floor, I was sharing my room with 12 other guys, but we were all together, we were eating together, we all went into departments which we had a passion for. Somebody went into the cards department, somebody went into the maintenance, somebody went into drama, and everybody was buzzing with activity. And I think Swami helped me convert my bookish knowledge into practical knowledge here. Like, he helped me to actually distill it and make it useful for me.
you know, all that you had studied in the books, now you are seeing how to actually put it in action.
Yeah, that's
experience
what
the joy, I mean,
yeah,
in real joy,
yes,
of living all that you had
exactly
sort of stuffed in your head.
Right. I think it's pertinent to share one of the experiences shared by James Sinclair.
Mm-hmm.
In our Radio Sai studios itself, in one of the interviews that we did for him some time back, was that, you know, Swami's message is like, one day Swami was with Sinclair alone, and that was one of the early days of Sinclair coming to Swami. And Sinclair is a very rich man.
Yes.
So the information is that he had ownership of a lot of diamond mines, etc., etc. So Swami was talking to Sinclair, and Swami said, "Sinclair, I want something from you." Sinclair then said, "Okay." So Swami knows that I'm a rich guy and that I own a lot of mines with diamonds and gold. So maybe he's going to ask me a big check for a donation or something for his institute. He said, "Yes, Swami, tell me, what can I give for you?" Then Swami said, "Promise me that you will always be happy."
That's what I want from you.
That's all I want from you. And he was totally blown away, and with such sincerity and such genuine affection, Swami had told him, "Promise me that you will always be happy." I think that is what Swami has helped me personally in all these years, to look at life from a perspective that it's a blessing, that the present moment is so important that you need to fill it with joy, you need to fill it with happiness, and you need to make it overflow so that others can share of that joy. So that's basically the answer to your question, that he literally taught me, which he must have done for each and every person who has come to the portals of this great institute, on how to lead a joyous, happy and balanced life.
Sai Ram, and welcome back to Morning Glory, coming to you live from the Radio Sai Studios in Prashanthi Nilayam, India. The time right now in Prashanthi Nilayam is 11:21 a.m. You just heard part one of a four-part Fleeting Moments interview with Mr. K. Arun Kumar. You can catch the remaining three parts of this very interesting and inspiring conversation right here on Morning Glory over the next three Thursdays. Meanwhile, we eagerly look forward to your feedback to all our programs. It would be so very nice to know your thoughts on the Fleeting Moments interview with Mr. K. Arun Kumar and the Tryst with Divinity interview with Mr. Ryuko Hira that I played for you earlier on. With that request, it's time for me to offer Morning Glory at the Divine Lotus Feet. Till we meet next Thursday, please be well, stay inspired, and do whatever it takes to stay positive. Up next, Seva, Love in Action with Raghu. Sai Ram.